Well, hello everybody. We've got very. I am obviously being picked up here. That's good. We've got a very distinguished panel today. We had a wonderful start from Michael Billington this morning. We raised lots of issues, and I'm sure we should have more issues raised during the course of the next hour and a half. You all have programmes, I hope, in which our approaches are given. All the speakers only very briefly. Say we have a mixture here of practitioners and critics. Traditionally, there's a degree of enmity between critics and practitioners, but they all seem fairly equable at the moment. To my far right, Michael Coveney. On my immediate right, Carol Ratter. Here, Janet Sussman, Andy Dixon, The Guardian, and Tim Supple, the director, who was referred to in Michael's talk this morning. And we've asked each member of the panel to speak for a few minutes about their own attitude towards criticism, towards theatre criticism and reviewing. And when that's happened, we'll go into a more general discussion on the panel here. And we'll proceed, therefore, through relative formality to presumably total chaos at the end as we ask questions from the audience. So let me ask Michael to start. We can go over the break to lecture.
Oh, yes.
Could you use the mic? Yes, please.
Right. Is that right? That's working. My approach to criticism, yes. Remember there used to be a very civilised guy called Eric Cow. He used to write... Sorry?
There used to be a very civilised man called Eric Cowan, curiously spelled K-E-O-W-N, so I may have got the pronunciation wrong. He wrote for Punch in the days when we had weekly magazines where there were long and learned essays on the contemporary theatre and indeed Shakespeare. When Michael Billington refers to the luxury of 2,000, 3,000 words, it's a thing of the past. And we were just saying upstairs, well, maybe the Sunday papers. Well, I used to be on The Observer and I used to have 1,200 or 1,500 words. And of course, the way the theatre's gone, fragmented through so many manifestations, I ended up trying to cram four or five productions into that space. So that wasn't the answer either. There seems to be, and I think it's a very important point that we might discuss in this conference, not only a schism between newspaper reviewing and serious journal reviewing, academic reviewing, but a real threat even to the first from what is happening in our media at the moment. Some of it good, some of it not so good. My approach to criticism, anyway, Eric Cowan said, was through the front door of the theatre. That was the approach he tended to adopt, and then to absorb the play. But it is very difficult. You can't pin it down. If you're writing 500 or 900 words, you can start anywhere. In the real world of theatre, you could start discussing the lighting plot, or the acting, or how you felt that night, what is the mood of the audience. And I do feel that the theatre is a social function, and that the audience are the most important people in it. This is why I slightly take issue with Michael's very crucial point about the responsibility of a production towards a text in Shakespeare. I don't think a production has any responsibility whatsoever to any text by Shakespeare or anyone else. The theatre is the theatre, and Shakespeare can look after himself. I think it's different maybe with the Royal Shakespeare Company. There must be something in the charter somewhere that commits you to a responsibility towards the players, but I think even that is sometimes taken a little too earnestly. So my approach to criticism was really formed by the accident of becoming a theatre critic. So I started off writing overnight reviews and then more discursive reviews in theatre magazines, and then you write critical essays and you write other things, and it all becomes part of the same job in a way. I don't divide things up, and I didn't regard reviewing on the Daily Mail is anything much different from reviewing in the Observer. You can only write what you feel, not what you ought to say. And I think the guiding principles are that if you weren't enthusiastic or interested in doing it, you couldn't possibly maintain doing it over a week, let alone a year or longer, because 8,000 nights. I counted up, J.C. Truin had a wonderful book called 580 Hamlets. I counted up recently, I'd done 47 or 48, I think 49 now with Jude Law. So I'm getting there. And J.C. Truin was a wonderful old style critic, and he once wrote an essay for a programme of student production of Hamlet, directed brilliantly by the aforesaid and abused Jonathan Miller. And J.C. Trim wrote a wonderful essay about the fact that Hamlet had the most exciting opening scene in the whole of world drama, and it was brilliant. The only problem was that the production itself cut that scene. It went straight to Act 1, Scene 2. So there can be a discrepancy between commentary and production. That's probably too much of a ramble to start with, but I think my approach would really be, you write what's before you, you write for people who aren't necessarily going to see the production. W.A. Darlington, it was said, who was a critic for 35 years, never saw the end of Hamlet, so he didn't know what happened, because he was always meeting the Daily Telegraph deadline. But those days are gone. We don't leave at intervals, and we tend to stay to the end, the bitter end, and on we go. But there's so much in this topic that we will discuss later. That's the start.
Good, thanks. Carol, would you like to tell us a little more from the academic side?
I'm an academic critic, so I write the annual survey piece on the year's work in Shakespeare in performance. I'm not quite sure whether I've swapped from being a poacher to a gamekeeper or the opposite way around, because before that, I used the reviewing that is produced by these astonishing, and I mean really astonishingly, perceptive, insightful, creative reviewers like Billington and Coveney, John Peter, and others, in the kind of writing that I was trying to do in writing performance analysis, performance history, performance studies as academic criticism. There's a whole area of the academic work on Shakespeare that is trying to account for what happens in theaters and a history of performance, but an analytical history. So moving into reviewing has kind of put me on the other side of that fence. So I'm kind of sitting amongst the big boys now, looking at a production with, and God, what a smart question that was down here, whoever ever was on the floor. I basically was saying to Michael Billington, how do you do what you do? You know, how do you actually keep control of all of the myriad things that are happening inside of the production and remember with such detail to be able to capture that for the review? That's an art. And it seems to me that there's a real art in the craft of what they're doing as reviewers. But it also strikes me in terms of what is the state of this art. Richard Eyre talks about the theatre as the event, and when you're there, you're there. And if you weren't there, it's gone, it's past, it's vanished. You weren't there, you missed it, you will never be able to recover that performance. Now, it seems to me that what the reviewer is doing is standing on the cusp of that memory and is helping us at perhaps the level of really high-grade gossip to avoid the loss of that performance. So for me, the reviewer who is doing the best of the reviewing job is somehow to capture what the actor was doing, to contextualize what the actor was doing in terms of the whole performance, and that means what the lighting director was doing, what the director was doing, what the costumes were doing, but also to see that in some way illuminating Shakespeare and saying something about where Shakespeare is at the present moment, because there's no point in doing another Antigone or another Hamlet unless it's speaking to us. So knowing how that performance was speaking to us, to me, is what part of what the reviewer is doing. But I'm also interested in what isn't being spoken about so far in this discussion. It is true that since 1993, the last time I think Michael Billington wrote a long piece about the state of the art in The Guardian, there are many more women who are reviewing on national newspapers. But you'll notice that this morning when Michael was talking about Hamlet, and Hamlet, Jude Law's Hamlet, Tennant's Hamlet, Patrick Stewart's Claudius, the one spectacular performance that was given in that Hamlet, which no reviewer spoke about, was Penny Dowling.
Yeah.
Was the definitive Gertrude. And nobody noticed, not I think because they didn't notice, but because they had ultimately 400 words. And that to me is also one of the great differences in where I look at reviewing today and the reviews that I'm looking at, you know, going back when I'm excavating a performance of, say, 20 years ago, Billington Coveney had a lot more space to talk about the performance, and now it seems to me that it's much more like what Michael was talking about at the end, that you're giving kind of notices that are about maybe you should go to the theater, you've got 3 stars, 4 stars, but you're not actually able really to have the space to do the critical essay that is going to keep memory alive and going to capture what it was in the theater.
Good, thank you. Janet, would you like to look at it from your point of view, the artist's point of view?
I would, and yet I am bedazzled by so many thoughts which come at me. I like high-grade gossip, I think that's tremendously apposite in some way. However beautifully somebody writes, it is a momentary impression of the personality which either gets through to them that night or fails to. And here I am in another paradoxical situation, which is the actor himself or herself, who is, oddly, a black hole in the middle of this argument. Because it might or might not be an urban myth, but in my experience, actors cannot read reviews while they're performing. Because how can you read about yourself in black and white when that night you're going to do the thing that's just been described? You couldn't do it. If Mr. Keane had read that comment about how he did this and that, the next thing, gestures and tones of voice and everything, he would never be able to do it again. All actors know that. You will never find an actor or a director, indeed, in a rehearsal room, giving too particular a description of what it is they want to an actor so that their creative juices can perhaps flow. Too much analysis is not good for the creative spirit in performance. And yet there are pianists like Daniel Barenboim and Marie Pariah, people like that, who are absolutely exquisite at analyzing difficult things in music. And there are indeed actors of the first water who are able to use their brains as well as their guts. Most actors in the first rank can do that, though they don't care to admit it. I'm one of those who is a fragmented person in some way, because my youth was a very political one, and I can't help having that in my bloodstream. And there I was plunged like a prawn into a pot of boiling water, into a very political experiment, which was beautifully described by Michael as the Wars of the Roses, which was a State of the Nation essay by Peter Hall and company. And that was my first experience of great Shakespeare ever. And of course it's gone deep into my bloodstream. I find I can't look at any Shakespeare play without its political content. I just can't do it. I'm incapable. I'm almost incapable of seeing any other great writer in anything but a political kind of scenario. I can't look at English Chekhov happily anymore. I have to see it in a post-liberation night, and so on. So in a way, I'm the right person to have on this panel, and yet the wrong one. I know that I have a terror of reading in black and white what I'm doing, so I don't read it. Maybe afterwards, if you can still listen to William Trevor, a wonderful Irish writer the other day, saying that he completely lost interest in his novels once they were written. Once they were on the shelf, he could hardly even remember their titles. And in a way, an actor has the same reaction to performances. They stow them away somewhere in the back locker of their brains. And if I were asked about why I read, Bologna the way I did, I could give you a very cogent 10-minute peroration on exactly why I did that. That's in retrospect. At the moment that I did it, I wasn't prepared to justify the kind of life experience that having a child, son, had shoved into my view of the world. which corresponded with Volumnia. So there are many ways in which a maturing actor will see himself only in context. One of the things about doing Shakespeare is, of course, the text. And one of the most difficult things about doing Shakespeare is, of course, the text. We do like to cut it about a bit more now. There is a great deal more, you know, devil may care less about it, but always thought behind it. But what is the difference? Your experienced actor will know the difference between somebody who can deal with language and somebody who cannot. And I promise you, 90% of young actors in drama schools do not and cannot. So I have to ask myself, what is the difficulty with Shakespearean performances? There is a difference between just, you know, some old play and a Shakespeare play. So there are two things here. There is the experience and the expertise. There is a response to language has to be particularly intense and aware. There is the point at which the reviewer himself bowls your career along like a child with a hoop. It's fabulous if you get great notices. Your career bounds and expands and bounces around like a shuttlecock. I find it difficult, however, to see Patrick Stewart as the great man he is, because a long time ago, he and I were in the Library Theatre in Manchester doing a David Mercer play. I think David Mercer's first play. And he was in a string vest, and I was in a cotton pinion. And the shape of it was that I had to do a Lancashire accent in Lancashire. Me from Africa. Yeah. But Patrick holds no secrets for me. It's difficult to see. You won't ask me, and I won't tell you. But I mean, it's sometimes difficult to see the mystery that others see on the stage, if you're in it. And that's another difficulty, I think, that performers have, is seeing just what glow it is that has mesmerized somebody out there, when you know perfectly well something else. Also, I think actors' tastes are different. There's an actor's actor and there's a non-actor's actor. That's also a well-known little syndrome, I think, in the small company of actors in any country, is that they rate people and a secret star system, which is very different from the one that appears in the...
Well, thank you. So the actor acting is a job. For the spectator, it's an entry into a mystery,
yes,
perhaps.
Yes, yes.
Andy, can I ask you to speak from the blogger's point of view?
I'll do, yes. Can everyone hear me? It's very quiet from where I am. Yes, it's still switched on. It's really interesting hearing these responses to Michael's talk, which I thought was fascinating. I guess it made me think of a couple of things. I suppose really because of sort of where I am in terms of what I do, which is that, I was about to say I have a foot in both camps in terms of the internet and newspapers. Actually, I mean, there are more and more camps each day and more and more, I'm required to have more and more feet. Essentially what I do is I edit the online art section of The Guardian, which is, of course, you know, a newspaper, also has a website as well. So I sort of look kind of both ways, I suppose. One way back towards what the newspaper does and the production of that newspaper day in, day out, and all the things that we've been talking about, space and deadlines and the practical issues of producing newspaper, which are kind of incredible when you stop to think about it. You know, I remember hearing Alan Rosbridge, the editor of The Guardian, on the Today programme last year sometime, talking about the ways in which the newspaper industry, I mean, it surely must be the only industry which survives relying on small boys being prodded out of bed each morning to go and deliver the newspaper. I mean, you know, the distribution of it is incredible, and incredible, I mean, in a positive way as well, in terms of what is done each day. And I also look towards the web, obviously, and at things like blogging and things like video on the internet and audio and various different things. So, in some ways, I suppose I sort of stand on the boundary between those different things. I guess I suppose what I feel, and in some ways Michael said this very clearly, I think, is I think I agree with him that Shakespeare reviewing more generally, criticism, whatever you want to call it, is in flux. I suppose I feel perhaps quite positive about that, I think there are lots of different things changing, and there are some terrible things happening. I mean, if you like newspapers and believe that newspapers are important, it's terrible that there is a crisis in classified advertising at the moment, which means that newspapers are shrinking. That's partly due to the recession, that's also because of the web and the different ways that the economics of the whole market are working. But there are interesting things happening too. There are very, very interesting things happening in blogging, as I mentioned, in different kinds of reviewing that are happening online. Also fantastic projects such as Theatre Voice, website that is about creating kind of, I suppose, what would have been called radio to do with theatre. Far more specialist, far more interesting often than the kind of thing that would happen in mainstream audio. And I suppose in my good days, I feel really optimistic about all that. I think that it's very, very important there is a kind of mixed economy of reviewing and criticism that is, on one hand, I suppose, contains academic reviewers who have many thousands of words and a long time in which to think about creating those words in order to distill an essence of what a production was, whether it's a Shakespeare survey or a Shakespeare quarterly, or indeed in any different academic context, a considered perspective, writing for posterity about what a production did and is and where it's situated. At the other side of that, you have the kind of gossipy world of bloggers, people like the West End Whingers. I don't know if anyone looks at their websites. You often learn more about what the West Enders have for dinner than what they actually saw on stage. That is part of the point. I mean, I remember meeting them, and they're famously anonymous, but I did actually, they do exist, and I have shaken hands with them. And the ways in which they were saying, well, actually, we're not critics, we don't see ourselves as critics. What we do is frivolous gossip. But it's part of what the theatre-going experience is. So, like I say, in my good days, I feel optimistic about all that, that there is a range of different voices, and that whereas criticism might once have been a bit like a kind of medieval siege where actors and directors throw things out across a wall to an audience and maybe it lands in the right place and maybe it doesn't land in the right place, and then critics throw something back the other way and maybe, instead now I sort of think when it works well, the system works well, the gates have kind of opened and those people talk to each other much more sort of dialogue between practitioners and reviewers and members of the public. And I think what I would worry about, and I think maybe an interesting point to perhaps talk about just in closing really, is kind of where that leaves us. Because I think that people have, and I have been very, very positive in the past about the way that blogging and different forms of criticism on the web can really enliven and bring fresh juice and fresh life to the whole scene. It's also true that a lot of blogging is not particularly good, and that bloggers, and I think the best bloggers would acknowledge that themselves, there is a pressure there, and they need to create a pressure to be as good as possible, to not to just devolve into kind of mere gossip and chatting about what you had for dinner, but actually to really engage and think creatively about how you talk about the theatre. And I was just going to leave with a quotation actually, which I picked up from a blog just the other day, which is a blogger called George Hunker, who's an American theatre practitioner. I'm sure many of you will know his blog, and he writes a blog called Superfluities. And he's a brilliant writer in many ways, not least because he's very, very critical of the world of blogging. And he says, really in response to the way in which he sort of detects a sense that blogging is sometimes too trivial and isn't really engaging with the real issues. And he says, I don't believe this is the fault of the medium, per se, but rather the assumptions that have become attached to blogging, that the ideal blog post is short, informal, personal, what have you. He says, I'd like to meet the Plato who decided this was the ideal. And I think it's a really interesting point. I think at its best, and this goes for all kinds of theatre writing and indeed criticism more generally, it should be continually self-examining and saying, what assumptions am I starting from? What am I attempting to do here? Who am I serving? And as long as it keeps doing that, I think it will be in good health, but it's important that it does.
Thanks very much. Tim,
Is that what?
You're
already
wired,
are you?
Yeah.
Am I wired? Is it? Yes. Okay, great. It's so many interesting thoughts already after only a couple of hours that I kind of wish I hadn't paired some thoughts, but I have, so I'm going to stick with them for the moment, and I hope they play in some useful way with all the other interesting things that have been talked about. And obviously there are, as being referred to, there are so many different kinds of critics, and I've found the reviews of academic critics as interesting and as important as the media reviews, but I'm going to be talking mostly about the media reviews because they have been the most present kind of reviewing in my working lifetime, and obviously it's through the media reviewers that, and mostly those the written media reviewers, that our work interacts with the public most. So I'm mostly talking about that, although there's a bigger discussion about other things. And I start from a perspective for myself that the theatre critic is a specific professional, creative, artistic animal, and has to combine, but be different to, but combine aspects of, the academic critic like Jan Kopp, Stanley, Peter Holland, the historian, Jonathan Bate, and the practical critic who can talk about the art of theatre. They're like the director, they're a kind of hybrid, but very specific art form. In the bitchy world of theatre, critics come in for a lot of stick. I noticed that as soon as I started working in the theatre, and it carries on. But I think that they're an important and undervalued professional group, and I think that their function is often misunderstood by professionals, perhaps by editors, perhaps by punters, I don't know, but certainly by professionals. So I kind of asked myself in coming this morning, what do I think that we generally think critics are for? What do they do? And it seems to be that there's two functions we expect from them. And in part, it's to inform an audience about a performance, either to invite them to see it, or suggest they don't see it, or give them a so-so, or to tell the audience what the show was like, if it's a short run or so on. And in part, I think they're there to respond to what's on stage, and therefore to form a dialogue with artists, which is part of the ongoing evolution of theatre. And I would argue that the former is wrongly taking far greater precedence over the latter in recent times, that the emphasis has become so increasingly on telling an audience something, and so decreasingly in being part of a dialogue and the evolution of the theatre art form. Now, I think that examples of this have been mentioned already. Obviously, giving star ratings, which for me is a disaster for serious criticism. It might be a good thing for telling an audience quickly, good, bad, indifferent, but it's a disastrous, for me, thing to ask a critic to do. Shorter columns, which has been mentioned. And I think equally corrosive is the emphasis on critics having to say whether they think something is good or bad. Just like that. The cultural tide that we live in is surely going towards the anyone can do it thing. I mean, obviously Britain's Got Talent, the way that even, I think, again, disastrously, some of our leading producers have played this game and cast shows in collaboration with these kind of TV talent shows. I think they're examples of that zeitgeist of the anyone can do it thing. And the blog, which it's great that Andrew's here, and I really believe there must be very positive things about the blog, but the danger of it is, again, the anyone can do it mentality. And of course, anybody should be able to stand up and have a go at singing, and anybody should be able to say what they thought about a show, of course. But it mustn't lead us to think that we can undervalue learning, training, experience, knowledge, the accumulation that makes an artist or a craftsperson who they are. That's the danger. I think that, sorry, forgive me for a second. This is my terrible. Michael says his writing's bad in the dark, my writing's bad in the light. I think actually it's years as a director, you write notes in code so no one can read them. Okay. Okay. I think that there are two threats, therefore, to the quality of our reviewing in the future. And one, I think, is this ubiquity of the problem with the ubiquity of online comment, the online world for me, is that we might confuse giving opinion with critical review. I think that's one great danger. And the other is that the lack of value that we place on reviewing as a profession seems to me to be leading to the lack of a next generation of reviewers. Michael threw down a challenge and he asked me upstairs if I could name that very talented under 30s Shakespearean director. I haven't got it yet, I'm sure they're there. And I threw back the question, can we name the good under 30s reviewers coming through? Maybe Andrew will know their name from the blog. But I think that, like theatre administration, it's an undervalued profession in which it may be ignorance on my part, but I don't see how the younger reviewers are being trained, encouraged, and brought to a place that where they can carry on this important job. There's one complaint you hear a lot, which came up in the media a couple of years ago, the complaint that too few have been doing it for too long. And indeed, some of the guys that have been mentioned today have been around since I started, before I started directing. And it's not in itself a bad thing, of course. It depends on the quality of the person, like in anything, the quality of the work that they do. If it's not good, of course, it's a nightmare that they're around for 40 years. But in itself, it's absolutely no bad thing. I've only wished sometimes that the reviewers could have the experience of being reviewed, because I think actually, for me, it has formed a profound, I was mentioning Mr. Michael upstairs, a profound part of the development of my work as a director. And I've sometimes wished that there was a way of the reviewers being reviewed. I don't know by who.
We can just blog.
Yeah, maybe that's the blog. Because of course there are qualities like how well you write, how well you articulate what you're doing as a reviewer that demand attention. And obviously if someone's going to be around for 30, 40 years, then they could do with that response. But actually, I think that over the years, I've become to fully appreciate the long vision and experience of the professional reviewers. And, you know, the talk that Michael gave, that someone can give that overview within a historical context of reviewing, of Shakespeare, is a very precious thing. And when you travel, as I've done a lot, when you go somewhere where that doesn't exist, then you really appreciate it as a theatre artist, and I'm sure you would as an audience. I think the most corrosive trend in recent years in this media reviewing world is putting people into the job who aren't theatre critics, but who might be clever, opinionated, successful writers in other fields. It's a real shock. If you take your work seriously as I do, and you put the work on stage, and you want reviewers to review it seriously, to one day open the Observer and find your work reviewed by a court correspondent, or open another newspaper and find your work reviewed by basically a political and social commentator. And you know, I think that it's the issue is Shakespeare. Is that Shakespeare is particularly difficult and particularly important to our theatre culture. He's been mentioned, a few of these aspects have been mentioned so far. He's done so much, he's seen so often, and a reviewer sees the work again and again and again. And so I think Shakespeare, reviewing Shakespeare, is particularly vulnerable to, perhaps you could say, three of the deadly sins of reviewing. One is when a reviewer looks at the work so totally in terms of their own prejudice, rather than being able to open their eyes and open their thoughts to what's in front of them. Another is the lazy opinioning, the good and bad, this is good, this is bad thing. And another is the faultless comparisons. Of course, placing a performance in the context of another performance, a production in the context of another production, is an important thing, but the faultless comparisons is what we...
That's where the historical sense comes in, isn't it? I mean, in a way, it seems to me what you're saying is that there could not be a good critic who was under 30. There might be a good director who was under 30, but what you seem to be suggesting that criticism requires experience.
Well, I think that's...
How do you start, I ask with them. When I graduated from university, my highest ambition was to become a theatre critic. I'd read a great deal of theatre criticism. I'd read James Agate, and I'd read Shaw, and I'd read all the Montague and all the great critics.
And I went around the employment agencies trying to get a job. And very sensibly, nobody gave me one. I began to think about, you know, what would a qualification be? I thought, well, one qualification would be go to the public library and read as many plays as I could, in the fact that I couldn't see as many plays. I was in Hull, not a terribly good place for seeing very, very few plays. But it does seem to me that we are concerned with this question of when does a theatregoer start being a critic? At what stage does this happen? I didn't become a theatre critic until I got quite a lot of experience, and of course I'm not a professional full-time theatre critic, but I have written and spoken a lot critically, and it was when I was eventually, because I was a Shakespeare person, invited to appear on Kaleidoscope, because really gave me my break, as it were, which was a different sort of criticism, of course, because that was the equivalent in this, almost of blogging, I mean, you know, 5 minutes. So what do we feel about this? Where does, what are the qualifications for a theatre critic?
Yes, it's a curious thing, isn't it? Because, you know, as my mother still says, when will you get a proper job? There is a feeling that it's not quite a proper job. And I think the good critic convinces himself that he is. I think Irving Wardle once said, you know, the idea that you might have a point of existing, a mission in the world, is a wonderful thing when occasionally it happens. But when I was thinking of after what Tim said, bringing this, and Andrew really, bringing this whole thing back to the Shakespearean side. And when Janet talks about the Wars of the Roses, you see, I was going to the theatre then when I was fortunate as a young boy. We were a good Catholic family, so my father took us to see A Man, Four Seasons in 1960. And we were going to the theatre, and we sort of got the theatre bug, my brother and I. We used to go and see everything. And we came and stayed in Stratford and in Mrs. Richardson's B&B, and we saw the Wars of the Roses. And it was unforgettable. There's nothing, you know, Janet's Joan LaPucelle, Brewster Mason's Warwick, right through to Donald Sinden. I must just get in a cheap gag here, but Stanley reminding us he comes from Hull. One of the great Hull actors is, of course, Tom Courtenay. And when he played his King Lear, stressing the marvellous sort of saint-like but non-belligerent aspect of his performance, Michael Billington, for it was he, said that Tom Courtenay's King Lear was more sinned against than Sinden. He thought I wouldn't remember that. But only a critic with the experience and knowing exactly what he meant by saying that, and therefore his readers also of a certain age, would value the, you know, the wit of such a cheap remark. It's seeing the Wars of the Roses. Theatre was in my blood, you see, and then you go to university and you think you're a director and you start directing plays. And then what I did was I applied for a trainee directorship, which one of the earlier recipients was Trevor Nunn, and we thought, well, if he can do it, anyone can do it. And you apply, and one of the things in the final round with a few of us was to write a couple of reviews of things we'd seen. And I'd seen O Calcutta in New York, and I'd seen Tiny Alice at the Aldwych. And I'd hated them both, and of course, as we all know, it's much easier to be negative in a spirited way than to be positive. That's one of the things you learn is not true as you get older, or not valuable, necessarily. And so they read these reviews, and the judging panel included my future arts editor and mentor, B.A. Young, a very civilized critic of whom David Edgar once said, that man would hang glide to the Orkneys to give me a bad review. on the panel were theatre directors like Giles Havergal of the Citizens and Clive Perry and Michael Todd from the great producer. And they read what I'd written and they turned to Freddie Young of the Financial Times and said, "We don't want him, you do." And about 18 months later, I was taken on there as their third string fringe theatre critic. And in the meantime, I got involved in a theatre magazine called Plays and Players. So it's a sort of series of accidents. But there was a moment when I crossed the Rubicon, and I thought, well, I could do that. And there was a moment when a director of the Royal Court called Roger Crouch said to me, and my eyes lit up as though, you know, I'd won the job, "You could be the next Michael Billington." And vistas of possibility opened.
The next Michael Billington is still not needed.
And I never, I did think for a few years I would go on and do something, but then, you know, I realised there was nothing more important for me than to do this. And I think that's
it's obviously very important to feel faith in what you're doing.
You're actually
like,
you know.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
yeah, true. That notion of getting a proper job, though, it's one of those things that also bedevils actors, doesn't it? Some of their mothers in my history suggest to them that they might think about getting a proper job. And so there may be this sort of a symbiotic relationship between these two arts and crafts that are being practiced. But the question that you ask is, what is the qualification? Well, there isn't any qualification, is there? There is something that you realize when you read excellent criticism, and that is an investment. That is a genuine investment at a political level with the health of the art at the present time in the UK. I think Ken Tynan had that in spades. You know, he desperately wanted a committed theatre, a live theatre that was working in conversation with British history at the moment. And I think that's why going back and reading his reviews makes such a splendid engagement with theatre history in the 1950s. So there's that. I think there's an interest.
Okay, well, that's a qualification. There are lots of qualifications. You've got to be able to write well. You've got to have an analytical mind. You've got to be able to, ideally, have quite a good bit of experience. You've got to be able to tell good acting from bad acting. You've got, in my view, also, to consider the relationship between the text and the performance. And this is something which we seem to have differing opinions about. How The Wars of the Roses rather crystallised it. John Barton wrote 1,400 lines in The Wars of the Roses, not Shakespeare. He was taking off from Shakespeare. But this raises the very interesting question of the degree to which productions are self-creative. Are they interpretations, or are they creations? To some extent, you recreate. This is something that Michael certainly very much touched on in his closing remarks about what makes a good production, whether it's something which has its own artistic validity, irrespective of the text that lies behind it, or whether it's a text, as you might feel with, well, the same thing comes in music. Janet raised the question of musical interpreters, you know, the difference between a Furtwängler and a Bolt, or a Beecham and Charles McHarris, perhaps. You know, with some great artists, you feel that they are bringing a lot of themselves to Beethoven, to adding it to Beethoven. And you may feel they're adding it to Shakespeare too, and I'm not sure that there's anything wrong with that, as distinct from those where you feel they're subjugating themselves to the work of art. What do you think, Janet?
I don't know. I think I'm going to digress a little bit to the extent that I sometimes have a nagging feeling in the pit of my stomach that too much reviewing takes the responsibility out of the public's brain for judging for themselves. Because I know when I'm talking to, let's call them civilians, that they say always the first thing, did you read that review in? Or have you seen so-and-so's review? And if you say to them, what did you think of the play? They can't say. Most often, I have found, they find it very difficult to formulate thoughts for themselves about a complex piece, which is always a Shakespeare play. It's always complex. You've always got so many strands to pull out of it. And unless they're told in black and white writing on a page what to think, they find it difficult, and I find that a bit worrisome, I have to say.
Can I just say about that? For me, that is why the opinion culture is problematic, because actually, I've got a problem with the post-show, you know, when you're invited to post-show discussions with audiences, and I actually don't mind not having those discussions. I'm quite happy for people to go home and not have to say what they think. And actually, what you end up is hearing the same things at discussion after discussion, because actually, to articulate your thoughts about a performance is a difficult thing.
Yeah.
And I you might be right, but my instinct is more that people shouldn't worry about articulating their opinion. Hindus too much, and that they should just take the experience and not have to give back, which is another reason why I think we need good reviewing of all kinds, because we need articulation.
Well, I was recently, don't ask me why, a friend invited me to see a Schauburger production of Hedda Gabler in Alsace. No, I was there, and there was an after-show discussion of such a high order, I cannot tell you. Admittedly, it was in French, so maybe I could.
You always sound better in French.
But such cogent insights into the play. I mean, about the character, the motivation, and this and that from everybody in the audience, and I thought, well, maybe they don't have 11 newspapers to cope with every morning, too.
But they do. They do.
Yeah.
It's a highly reviewing culture, Europe.
It is.
Yeah. It's a highly intellectual, much more intellectual theatre.
Yeah,
but it seems to me that you're putting your finger on precisely that thing that differentiates between an audience member and a critic, is that the critic is the one who goes home and struggles to translate the event into something that then can be published. And it is a struggle. I'm doing this at the moment. I know you sweat blood, and that I think is also why I have such deep respect for those people who do this on a daily or weekly event and do it quickly. And
you know, I sometimes feel when I was on the Deadline newspapers I worked for, you know, that unless you'd actually had to write 900 words about All's Well That Ends Well by 5 to 11, you haven't really lived. And people say, how do you do it? I said, you just imagine a gun at your head and you go for it and you do it. It's surprising that I know you develop a facility and it never gets easier, as Michael and I well know. Every night is a first night, and every first night review is in a sense a nightmare and a challenge. And that's what's, I think, exciting. I do like the blood sport side of it. But in the general context, could I just introduce something, Sandy, about the contextual? And perhaps Peter will discuss this or touch on it later. I'm fascinated by the fact, and I lost the thread there with the Wars of the Roses, that the Royal Shakespeare Company did that. Rediscovered those plays for my generation, certainly, and defined this company to a large extent by that production. And yet, within this short time span of the Royal Shakespeare Company, they've rediscovered the plays in their original.
Yeah.
At least twice, I think, starting with Adrian Noble, and then Terry Hands.
Yeah,
Terry Hands first, and Adrian in the Plantagenets to a certain extent.
Well, the same thing happened with the Tides of America. I mean, Peterborough cut it to ribbons, and
yeah,
a great production. And then Deborah Waller kept it as Lady Grey. And then the investment.
Sorry, Andy, what do you have?
There's so much to talk about, but I guess I'm sort of interested by this sort of. I'm a bit worried by this potential division between the kind of the superhuman critic and everyone else. I mean, to me, I'm sure that no critic would honestly say, certainly Michael and the other Michael, one keeps on learning, I suppose, and there are things that you know you develop and you gain experience, and it's an imperfect art. It's not as much as a skill, perhaps, but I guess I'm sort of interested by sort of what I was hinting at earlier, that there should be a range, and, you know, I mean, I feel I should speak for young people too, I mean, in the sense that, yes, experience is of course entirely important, and it's very, very important that we hear from those voices. I think that other people with different kinds of experience have views also, and I think that also, really what you were saying, Janet, about the idea of people just spouting reviews, or have you read this review, have you read that review? I think that is as much to do with having many reviews around and people not being encouraged enough to think for themselves. I think that in some ways, maybe it's naive to hope this, but in some ways I think that the kind of democracy that blogging and other kind of web forms of criticism can offer is actually people to develop the space and offer them the opportunity to publish what they think. And perhaps, then is it too naive to say that maybe it will get better and more interesting, that the conversation will be less about people up here and people down there and more about maybe meeting in the middle sometimes?
I agree, it's a great time of flux, but I think there's a sense of people of my generation and then the next generation of Michael's that it's back to the walls time. You know, there is a problem, not only with the hierarchy of the primacy of the higher arts, if you like, in review coverage because of what's happening in the culture, that the theatre review doesn't enjoy the status it once had, and also it's something to do with also maybe the best critics of the past 40 years haven't written about the theatre. there's another big subject. But in Shakespeare terms, it's very important that we are around, I think, to monitor the fact that, you know, that, for instance, Troilus and Cressida and Measure for Measure are the great discovered sort of new Shakespeare plays of the last 50 years. And it's only a critical mind that has experienced those productions, those shifts in the evaluation of the play and the versions of the play over the years, especially in the case of Troilus and Cressida, that how absolutely essential it is that there is someone still who can do that. Maybe Stanley and Peter and the academic Carol would tell us that we're coming to the end of that. There's no more great discoveries. There's nothing more for that kind of area or for the media critic to do in that respect about the rediscovery of these plays. But I still find it exciting about Shakespeare that you can have a whole new view, as I have lately had, of The Merchant of Venice, for instance, a play I now hold in much higher esteem than I once did. And that, as Michael says, the great joy of rediscovering the history plays almost every 10 years. And it is a part of the job to do that. And it isn't a part of the job to cede the function of criticism to people who just have opinions.
But of course, what you're rediscovering is what you saw in the theatre. So it's that symbiotic relationship between the great actor and the great director who's directing, who's seeing, who's imagining, who's putting something there for you to look at that then you see as a discovery. And it seems to me that's one of the wonderful qualities of what it is that you're doing as a reviewer, is to be the witness of this occasion, to remember it, to record it, to be the hedge against amnesia for the next generation. Because just as, you know, as we talk about, as directors talk about, say, or Jana was talking about where the young actors who can do this high colloquial English that is required to speak good Shakespeare, where is that generation coming from? We're talking, and Tim is talking about, where's the next generation of reviewers coming from? And Mike was talking about, where's the next generation of directors coming from? It's only by the experience of everybody being in the theater and watching this great this art happen that we will generate both the next generation of actors and directors and reviewers. But it's the state of the art inside the theater, it seems to me, that we should be really concerned about. And maybe the most important question to ask about there is, how much does it cost for young people to go to the theater? Mm-hmm. When Michael Billington was traveling down, you know, to see these plays, when you were going in to see these plays, how much did it cost you in terms of your real income, your real economy?
Yeah, how much did it cost in relation to a football match or a pop artist, for example?
But you see, actors, I mean,
wasn't
it? Tim, you all remember there was a big meeting at the National Theatre Studio 10 years ago with Peter Hall and Trevor Nunn and everybody terribly worried.
About
that. Yes, that theatre itself is insane with what about young actors and their ability. It's to do with English speaking and English teaching in schools.
What about the fact that in schools, although the Royal Shakespeare Company is heavily involved in the schools programme, Stand Up for Shakespeare, and every child of four should have read Titus Andronicus. But I've lately discovered that
every child of four has played
the GCSE, I now discover, is this true that they're only required to read scenes from a play?
Yeah.
Because reading a whole play might damage them for life. I mean, when I did O-levels, I had to learn Macbeth from start to finish. Admittedly, I had a very masochistic Jesuit English master, but we knew the play by heart, and it wasn't a great problem. It wasn't a problem to read a Shakespeare play when you're 14 or 15.
Yeah, but what about when you're 7 or 8? Or, yeah, well, 10 or 11? I mean, I was a school teacher once, and I had no shame in selecting scenes from plays. The Shylock scenes from the Merchant of Venice are example, perfect good way. You've got to introduce the young people to start with, and I see nothing wrong with it introducing them through single speeches. The greatness of Shakespeare's writing, of his poetry, which is only one aspect of his greatness of a dramatist, but it's an important aspect, and one which the RSC seems in some danger of forgetting about. It seems to me that there are so many different ways of introducing.
Well, when reviewers, just to say, sorry, I think political correctness is something which lies like, I don't know, jam over the toast of my. Young actors in a group are really scared of sticking out. They don't want to be. They don't want to be particular. They want to be just like everybody else. They want to speak up. they don't want to change their accents because they might lose something like a Maasai warrior losing his soul to a camera. I'm not being rude about it, it's just the way it is in a group of actors, young actors. They are very pussy-footed, careful about, you know, being too vivid, too eccentric, too idiosyncratic. They don't want to do that. They want to be like everybody else because we live in that sort of an age now. So the vividness of Shakespeare's language is somehow, there's a battle for them. To use any old word in any old speech in any old play in Shakespeare and make it suddenly become as surreal as it ought to be is really hard for them to do. They can't commit themselves to that. It's maybe different in foreign lands, because I have worked in South Africa where the language is then sifted through, it's somebody's second language, not their first language. So their shyness about it is of a different sort, completely different sort. But usually young actors in a rehearsal room just don't want to stick their necks out.
It applies to older actors too, I would say. I mean, it's something I think about in terms of enjoying Shakespeare's language. Now, I could give you an example of a senior actor who played a senior role here not all that long ago, who simply was, well, all right, let's face it, because David Warner is Falstaff. He wasn't enjoying Falstaff's language enough. The same was true to me of an actress who's playing one of the heroines of the plays this season. By enjoying it, of course, I don't mean indulging in it, I don't mean sort of ranking in the language, but I mean appreciating, as you are suggesting, I think, the vividness, the originality.
That's something to do with hearing.
Kids are
so visual. They don't actually hear oddness in the language very much anymore. And I think one of the
but when
Michael described so well, I'll move forward in a minute, is that the design has overtaken the theatre going experience very, very crucially, I think. We look for sophistication in first of all in the things we see, in second of all the things we hear. More, you know, the boat used to need to go near a plane. That's longer. Now, you really do go to see the plane. And I think that has been there's been a shift in the way the audience sits in their seat, what attention is paid to what is happening. And listening to a long speech coming out of somebody's mouth is more difficult.
This continues to perplex me. When reviewers talk about the state of verse speaking in England today, when they complain about the quality of actors speaking, what are they talking about? What are they really trying to get at when they use that phrase? And I wonder whether Tim, from the point of view of directing young actors, could think about or talk to us about what it is that he's doing in the rehearsal room with actors that are taking this vivid speech and giving it to us, in Your Eyes You Like It, for example,
well,
at the Curve.
I'm happy to very briefly respond to it, although I'm not sure quite how it connects to, we're going to talk about reviewing, but for me, the issue with verse speaking is very interesting what Janet was saying. I didn't quite recognise it, because I think that things change. One of the things that's changed is actors want to speak in their own voice more. Personally, I think that's a good thing. I think that language changes, theatre production changes, it's changing. We've got to live with that. What I found in rehearsal, which makes Shakespeare difficult, is the younger actors just don't understand the words. They just don't have the intellectual training to know what they're saying. And actually, the 6-week rehearsal, like For As You Like It, about 5 weeks is spent on decoding, really. And then to get it inside the body and make that live, you've got such a short time to do.
Doesn't this suggest a certain superficiality about the idea of standing up for Shakespeare, as if you can stand up and speak it without any sort of training?
But also,
to return more to the idea of reviewing.
Because this is a real big issue of what reviewers are reviewing as the state of the art, is what it is that they're seeing in front of them. But
in terms of
say Nick Heitner's complaint about the actor education, that it's spending far too much time on the theoretical and not enough on the practical, and then you're saying that it takes you 5 of your 6 weeks to decode the play with these actors, is there a space where young actors could make much more use of the kind of thing that, say, Stanley or I or Peter Holland could do with them in terms of teaching or thinking them through the text.
Well, Adrian Noble said many years ago that the actors used to come from drama school with that, a certain amount of that, but they don't anymore, so it is a problem. But, I mean, you're right. To be a musician, to play a Beethoven piano concerto, you have to be able to play a Beethoven piano concerto. To play Hamlet, I don't have to be. I could play Hamlet.
Yes.
I mean, it wouldn't be very good. But you can do it. And when Stanley talks about good, you have to really do between good and bad acting. I don't know what that is. I don't know what good acting is really. And you can find.
You do when you see it.
Well, you can find as many people who thought Olivier was a ham as a good actor. And I think the empirical definition of what is good, or what is appropriate, or what is even interesting about the theatre, is impossible to define. Which is, of course, what makes the theatre so fascinating.
But it's also it's also a responsibility for the critic to acknowledge that the critic's opinion. His opinion is an opinion, and to recognise that other people will have different opinions. And this is why it's rather difficult to be a moderate critic, isn't it? It's so much easier to be only taking a positive point of view than to try to be fair all round and say, I don't like the way Hymen is played in The Current As You Like It, but other people do. I mean, and I don't like it because my interpretation of the play is different from other people's. Now, I don't want to say that therefore I'm necessarily right, because I recognise that over the whole history of Shakespeare criticism, people have had the opportunity to pick it's partly because of the richness of Shakespeare's plays, which I think is what Jarrett was referring to, the way you can find so many different paths through these plays. That's partly why we want to go on seeing them, thinking about them, reading them.
But that is the job of the critic, and you don't have to be an academic as a responsible critic to identify what Michael discussed about Hamlet, the soliloquies in the order in which they were spoken, or in The Current As You Like It, the absence of the epilogue, or the appropriation of Aenian songs by Jaques. These are very, and the treatment of Hyland. These are crucial, fundamental things that it is the job and responsibility of the critic to discuss, whether he's in the TLS or in the Observer. And I think it's absolutely fundamental, and this kind of discussion has no place, it seems to me, on the blog or the democracy of opinion. That's what separates the critic from the public.
You want to go back on that idea as a blogger?
Maybe those
observations don't matter. Maybe they're not important.
No, I think they're absolutely important. And in many ways, if you look, for instance, simply within a newspaper environment, you know, we're talking about pressure on space and shrinking pages and all the rest of it. In many ways, the web doesn't have pressures on space. In fact, I mean, there is a bigger question about what newspapers are paying critics to do and what space they're allowing reviewers to work within. But you know, you could, in theoretically, write 3,000 words, 4,000 words on a particular production if that was possible. And there's not a space constraint on that. There are kind of real issues and questions about funding and limitation. I think it's probably worth talking about money a little bit, because I think this does tie into to kind of where are the next generation of critics? Because we were talking earlier about kind of people under 30. I mean, I've been 30 for 2 weeks now, so it's just all over. Yeah, I'm totally finished. But I think there's a real issue about how younger writers who I try and find and work with, and in fact, in many ways, The Guardian has done its best to try and find those. It's created space where there wasn't space before. You know, yes, we're not, and Michael is doing a fantastic job, Lynn Gardner is doing a fantastic job, but we've also opened space for other writers as well and given them a chance to write and to be edited as well, very crucially. But I look at their career paths and I think, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to do this? I was on another panel at the Royal Court about 8 months ago, and we were again talking a lot about this because there are a lot of sort of people who'd come out of doing a course at Holloway, one by Karen Fricker on reviewing and then the rest of it. And it's like, well, how do you actually become a reviewer? You know, you can be a blogger and of course you can publish, that's not a problem now, but how do you actually make money from it? And I think there's a real question there, and I think there's a real question for theatre organisations as well. And to come back to what Tim was saying, I think that it is in everyone's interest that there is a good critical debate. I say debate rather than just writing reviews, because I think it should be debate. I think theatres may need to think about how they pay for that too sometimes. I mean, you know, in all sorts of ways, the idea of the RSC sponsoring critics, I'm sure, will provide any number of people here with terrible images of, you know, well, who is owned by whom and who is, you know, what are people paying for exactly. But I think there's a real issue about democracy of opinion needs support, and if newspapers have supported that, you know, for the past 100, 120 years or so, if they're not going to be able to do it, who is going to be able to do it? Someone's providing an answer?
Economics is certainly crucial to the whole thing. It's crucial to the amount of space for things.
Yes, I mean, these practical considerations are now really kicking in, you know, that it was going out of town, for instance, as little and coming to Stratford, you know, 12 times a year. It was a badge of pride. It's what the job was. And you can't be a football correspondent if you don't go to Old Trafford. Equally, you can't be a theatre critic if you don't go to Stratford or to Manchester or to Newcastle or to Glasgow. I mean, it is just a nonsense. We were very metropolitan centric for a long time. But that thing did change for the good in the past, in my career, in 20 years, and now it seems to be under threat again, because if you're going to travel out of town, national newspapers won't be paying you the expenses.
There's no travel outside this country.
Yeah, there's no travel abroad, and I used to go to New York twice a year, whatever paper I was on, but that wouldn't even come into a discussion now. And I was down in Bristol just the other day, and most critics, I think Michael included, we drive and then we drive home, unless you find a park bench for the night. You know? And I said to Benedict Nightingale, are you driving home? It's from Bristol. He said, no, I'm staying over. I said, where are you? Because I was staying with a friend, and I said, where are you staying? He said, I'm staying in a hotel. I heard myself say, congratulations. I then heard myself, what was the hotel? He said, the Travel Lodge. And I'm afraid, you know, the idea that the Times critic stays in the Travel Lodge is kind of like a good indication of where we are. Guardian critics were sharing bedrooms, apparently, in Edinburgh this year. I don't think we want to go into that.
But
it is true. When I started, I got 12 quid a review, rising to £20 from the Financial Times in 1972. I remember those fees and proudly accumulating them. And in those days, you could live in London on an income of £100 a week. You could find a room in Kilburn, which I did, for £10 a week. It was possible. Now, I don't know what people do. I don't know how people survive. Also, the blogosphere has introduced a whole gang of people, hundreds of them, who write for nothing. You know, because they're just, you know, they're just...
They're a podcast.
Yeah, it's just like really worrying, you know. And I was invited to discuss what's happened to criticism by the BBC on the Culture programme the other day, and then told there was no fee. And I said to this whippersnapper producer, I said, before you were born, I used to do radio programmes with Michael Billington as the senior partner. The board service would pay us 75 quid to go on air in Broadcasting House to talk for 5 minutes, like a blog. But, you know, the BBC is paying its management levels now, and not its journalists, and certainly, you know, anyone who's talking about the arts. So it's quite scandalous. And the choice of people to write for nothing, I think, is a problem, and it's the downside of the blogosphere, I think, and it's not going to help the cause of serious criticism.
Sorry, I was just going to come back in. In a sense of a sort of beyond the economics, I think there's an interesting question. I think in a way that newspapers have slightly got themselves into this issue, and you were talking about it earlier, Tim, about the sort of the two functions of the review. Of course, there are many functions of the review, many things that critics should be doing, but the idea of a kind of consumer opinion, should I go and see this online, how many stars does it get, versus the conversation with posterity, the idea of the witness, the record of what this performance was actually like. And in some ways, again, in my more optimistic moments, I think actually the web can provide an answer to that, because I think that newspapers have got themselves into that situation. Editors think, well, of course, what we should be doing is telling people what they should go and see, we'll have critics' picks and all the rest of it. If there is a kind of a wider democracy of opinion about should I go and see the show or not, perhaps that can be supplied by, you know, a wider variety of people. There can be an interesting set of conversations around that, allowing the specialist critic, in theory anyway, to have a more specialist conversation. I often think, I mean, I don't know if you here who reads The New Yorker, but I often think that the division that The New Yorker has between the sort of small critics' reviews at the front of the book which are sort of 150 words or so on the latest film, which is done by a critic who has seen the film, so it is a review, saying more or less, should I go and see this or not? You know, what will I expect? Versus the long pieces at the back, which are more discursive reviews and probably really shouldn't be read until you've seen the film or seen the play or whatever. And I think that is an interesting sort of division. And I think if newspapers and media organisations are smart enough about it, and there are many reasons why I'm quite cynical about that, but if they're smart enough about it, that's sort of what the web can do, can say, okay, well, this review doesn't have to do these two functions identically. Maybe there are different things a review can do. Maybe those require different pieces of text.
I mean, there's a difference too, isn't there, between the music critic and the theatre critic. The music critic is always writing about something which is in the past, once his review, him or her review appears.
Exactly so.
You can get a 3-star review for the concert by the Berlin Philharmonic, which you can't go to because it's finished. It's completely different, the ball game, isn't it, reviewing music?
It really isn't. A friend who recently started as the theatre critic of the Globe and Mail in Canada, and because of the way that his deadlines work on the newspaper, he can't actually file overnight reviews at all. It's just a total no-no because it goes into the feature section of the paper, which goes to print at 2 p.m. or something. So what he actually does is he gets back from the theatre, he writes a quick kind of bloggy first impressions, I've just come out. I'm being honest about the fact that I've just come out. I'm not trying to pretend this is a permanent opinion that I will always hold. But this is what I'm thinking at the moment. And then a couple of days later, he writes a more considered review. I think that is a very tenable and interesting model. Instead of, you know, when you talk about, I can totally understand, and you know, anyone who's written to deadline will appreciate the thrill and the terror of writing to deadline. And of course, if one's good enough, one can produce fantastic, interesting observations and things probably you wouldn't do if you had 3 days to write it. And I get a little bit more worried about how those pieces of text continue to function. If that's just the one chance you get, if that's the only opinion you have and you never get to change it, I think that's probably a little bit problematic. So I think that in some ways, if we can think a little bit more intelligently about how reviews work in a different sort of time-based way, first impressions versus more considered opinions, different kind of conversations, that's actually quite a positive thing.
I would just like to hear from the experts why, actually.
Come on,
everybody.
You're
no, I'm not on anything. Why would it all have to come on the same day?
It's a very, very good point. I think in
this country, in Britain, it's a practical thing because there's so much happening. It's not like New York, where the New York Times critic goes two dozen times a season. There's so much. I mean, your diary is the same as mine and Michael. There's 5 openings a night now for the whole of September. It has to be regulated, and a very sensible way of doing it is to fix a press night on which people go. They're always trying to do the staggered thing. It just doesn't work, and it won't work, and they're going to do it again in the new year with a musical called Legally Blonde, but it's going to be a 5-day thing, and then an embargo. There is a problem, it's self-inflicted by the papers, with the deadlines, ironically, because of, you know, with the advance of technology, deadlines seem to have come forward, not only on the night, but also in the week. So you've got the Sunday Times, for instance, unless they go Tuesday, the production won't exist. The theatre should really make serious representations of these papers and put your reviews in the news pages so that we have Thursday night's opening in the paper on Sunday.
Well, that's another whole theme, the difference between reviewing and reporting. But I would like to open things up for a few minutes to questions from the audience, if any of you have any questions. Thanks. There's a lady here. Could you take this one?
For their comments on press nights, do they think that it attracts a particular kind of audience or performance?
Can I just come in because I was going to follow up on Michael with this. I can see, you know, having run a theatre and having explored all the issues, there are very good reasons why we have press nights. But I think it is one of the hazards and one of the problems with reviewing, because you never see a normal show. Now, that actually, in most cases, that doesn't really affect. A good critic will be able to see through everything and just see the performance in front of them. And yet, those nights are never the same as... Not only does it attract a different kind of person, it's often a ticket, it's often an invited house. Mm-hmm. It often involves a lot of VIPs and grandees. It invariably has a completely different atmosphere than any other night. Again, a good that won't matter to a good critic who won't review the atmosphere. I've got an example of a bad critic.
Oh, yeah, I think a good critic should review it.
I don't. I think the critic should, with steely eyes, review the thing in front of them.
My,
but
It disturbs the performance, I believe, press nights. And also, I've seen a very great actor, actress, who of course will remain anonymous, that I worked with, whose performance was entirely, she wooed the critics. She'd been lazy through rehearsals. She was lazy through the run. She had an amazing performance on press night. And she got the reviews she was after. Which is just an example of something that Janet said, that even the best critics have an innocence about some of the things that go on. And it was interesting hearing Michael's the Hazlitt review. I was thinking, you know, yes, extraordinary review of an extraordinary performance, but I bet that actor had a few tricks up his sleeve. But anyway, that's just by the by. So that's my opinion on press nights. I think they are problematic, and I don't think they help.
Okay, could we move to a different question? Yes.
It's one here.
Paul, you've got Paul?
Yeah,
Hi. I want to go back to Stanley's point about cost as it affects audience and as it affects the practice of reviewing and the comparison also with music criticism. Of course it's the case you can't go and listen to that concert that you're reading the review of. For 90%+ of those who read newspaper reviews, they can't go to the theatre production either. Either geographically, or because tickets are no longer available, or because they are disinclined to. So the relationship between the review and the possibility of the experience has always been, since long after Hazlitt, but certainly within our lifetime, disjunct. There is a separation. Now, part of that separation then affects the notion of who that audience might be. Just to be clear, if you want to go to see a play at the National Theatre, thanks to TravelX, there are hundreds of £10 tickets, which make it far, far cheaper than going to professional sport. The cost of a Premier League football game is many times the cost of going to the theatre. So
yes, it's sentimental to say that kids don't go to the theatre because it's too expensive. They don't go to the theatre because they give it lower priority than they do to things that cost a great deal more money in many cases.
And then we can see moments, and we're seeing it now, of distinct cultural shift. Tim's productions attract a very different audience because of their connection with different ethnicities who therefore become part of the audience. But talking a couple of weeks ago to Claire Higgins, who's playing The Countess and All's Well at the National at the moment, she described to me that one of the great shocks for her of being in that production is that when she looks out across the audience for the first time in her theatre career, playing Shakespeare, she sees a significant number of non-white faces in the audience. There is a distinct change in the audience for Shakespeare, and yet the reviewers are not really reflecting that change.
Okay, could we have another question? Or a question, sorry.
Yes, I've got a couple of points. One was the fact that you were asking where reviewers come from, and I would like to say that I've been an editor and a reporter, but nothing at all to do with theatre, and I would hate to become a reviewer, though I go to theatre quite a lot, and I mean a lot by comparison to most people, so I do have the same feeling as to where do you come. I think they are a breed of their own, but I think they also provide a record for history of what has happened in the theatre. And I think that is also a very important part of the reviewers. And the other side is, I also believe too, that the audience, as has just been noted, is changing. I have noticed that as well in many theatres now, that there is this change in the type of audience coming. I don't know why, but it is changing. You do see different coloured faces, you do see younger people coming.
Well, yes, every audience is different, and anybody who's lived in Stratford and gone over a season will know you get a different audience in March from the one you get in July from the one you get in December at the stage shape. You're on by the remote shows there. Sorry, could we have a question, please? Yeah.
Thank you. There's been quite a lot of comments about schools and school children. As a drama teacher and an examiner of theatre and a schools inspector, I see a lot of children working in schools. And I think, in their defence, I would say that there's a difference between schools and drama schools, and that drama schools are the place to train actors. Schools are the place to build audiences. And what a lot of schools are doing is a great job in making Shakespeare accessible in whatever form it might be, and to encourage them to go along to Shakespeare. And if we don't grow that audience, then a lot of you guys won't have a job. So it needs to be done, and I think they're doing a good job. So thank you.
Remind me of something I was thinking about earlier, which is that I was talking, forget who I was talking with, but the idea is a little bit about this conversation between audiences and critics and bloggers and all the rest of it, that and they pointed out that, of course, theatre went through this process 20, 30 years ago of bringing audiences into the light, of engaging them in productions, of not just treating them as a kind of dumb cattle in the dark who you don't engage at all. Actually, you know, audiences are much more visible, whether it's been, you know, kind of shepherded around a punch-drunk production, or indeed just even in productions of the National Theatre, which use the auditorium much more, or whatever. And I think in some ways that criticism is going through that process now, and perhaps a little bit belatedly, and I think also it's very, very early days. I think I'd resist trying to draw too many conclusions from what has happened really in the past 5 years. And I think it will be very interesting to ask where we'll be in the next 10 years, as Michael was asking. But I think it's that process of dealing with audiences and bringing in different constituencies to the theatre and allowing those people to engage. I can't see that as a bad thing at all. And I certainly sort of, again, I guess I come back to that point of that critics are people too, in the sense that not only that they are human beings, but that human beings, the rest of the mass of human beings, have opinions and need to be engaged with, and I think that's a very, very important point about theatre.
Sometimes a Shakespeare play is not a familiar object. If you don't play in England, it's a completely new animal. And having experienced a country where there are no theatre manners at all, because they're not inducted, they're not taught, children don't know how you should behave. Imagine if you could survive a matinee at the Market Theatre in Johannesburg, you could fight the Taliban.
Well, I know this thing could be through in our own Shakespeare.
Well, it is, but it isn't. And I think when something stands things on its head like that, when you also the most important thing is that the idea of silence is very different in Africa. Silence in Africa is threatening. It's as if the lights have been fused. There's something scary about silence. Whereas in Europe, no greater compliment can be paid than you could have heard a pin drop. That's frightening. But what, silence? It's not right. And so they vociferate. Or they, at moments of high, high drama, sometimes they laugh. Is it recognition? Is it because in the most terrible moment of a major character's life, they recognize something that they can diffuse by recognized laughter? I don't know the psychology of it, but it's very wonderful and very thrilling at the same time. And it makes you begin to look at plays in a very different way. And I think we go to a Shakespeare play with very huge monuments of received ideas in our heads, which is difficult to crack, like the Bamiyan Buddhas. It's really difficult to crack those ideas of what a character is.
Yeah, it relates to the fact that an audience is part of the experience.
Yes.
And that's partly why I think it is reasonable for a critic to write about the audience, because an audience plays its part. You've all played your part, thank you very much, and we'll go on talking for a long time afterwards. Thanks.